For almost 3 months, we've heard Donald Trump and others who stand with him boast about how they've cut that, reduced that, eliminated that. Their actions have impacted more than that being government agencies and departments. They've impacted people, people who are serving or have served in government, as well as the people who are beneficiaries of those programs and service. This is also more than just a short-term situation, too. Think about this. At this point, who would want to join government service designed to benefit those in need if they see that work at risk to a whim or multiple whims, depending on what day of the week it is? Joining us now to add a name and a voice to what we've all seen taking place is someone who for 20 years served as a part of the U.S. Agency for International Development, also known as USAID, which included being the director of the department's democracy portfolio in the Republic of Georgia. Today, she leads the organization Peace Builders Initiative and is the author of the upcoming book, Overcoming the Information Chaos, A Guide to Cultivating Peaceful Communities in the Digital Age. Danielle Reeve, how are you today, Danielle?
I'm fine, thanks, Chris. Thank you for having me on.
Well, I appreciate this time with you because, as I alluded to in the introduction, those of us on the outside are seeing what's happening as being things done to objects. And in fact, it's being done to people, isn't it?
Yes, it absolutely is being done to people. There are tens of thousands of Americans who have been put out of work by what's happening to the federal government right now. But not only people, Chris, I also want to emphasize that this is an attack on institutions as well, the institutions that ensure fairness and equality and, you know, that the country is run according to the principles of democratic governance. And so, yeah, it's people and it's institutions.
Let's start with something I think is important, because when someone wants to try to justify actions, I'll be gentle here. They'll be less than forthcoming and truthful about what they're addressing. What was the work of USAID? What were some of the things that it included?
Yeah, certainly everyone has their own interests in mind when they communicate about people, about places, about things. So it's just important for people to always be remembered. What is the agenda of the person who's telling me this information or giving me this story? That's one of the recommendations from my book about media literacy. But the U.S. Agency for International Development, people are concerned about fraud, waste, and abuse. The reality is the budget of USAID has long been less than 1% of the federal budget. So in and of itself, it is almost, you know, inconsequential in the broader terms of our federal budget. And that money is spent supporting our friends and neighbors around the world to strengthen their own institutions, to strengthen small businesses and the economy, to provide humanitarian assistance during disasters. That's one of the most important things we've done. You know, we've experienced a pandemic, a global health pandemic in recent years, but for decades, USAID has been working on public health systems in the countries where we've worked and stopping what could become global pandemics in their tracks in other places so that they don't actually reach American shores. So all of the work we're doing was elevated to the national security strategy. It was deemed to be important for our U.S. national security because by making the countries where we work as USAID function better democracies, more prosperous, and able to take care of the needs of their citizens, the less likely some of those toxic things are to reach America and Americans.
Reading up on some of the work of USAID, the image is it was handing blank checks to nations, to groups, to people, where to me it sounds more like the work of USAID was to empower people, empower third world countries to find strength within themselves so they could stand on their own.
That's right. That's very much correct, Chris. USAID has some of the most sophisticated accountability systems of any organization inside or outside government. You know, we provided and you still provide a little bit, but we're providing significant support to empower other countries to be a good neighbor, to help improve their conditions. And we did that with the approval of Congress. All of the money that was ever spent by USAID was approved, had bipartisan support in Congress. There were times when certain initiatives were questioned by Congress, and they would put a hold on our approval and say, well, we're not sure about that, and they would ask more questions or they would have hearings. They would gather more information and ultimately decide, is this something they want to move forward with or not? But USAID was not out there just writing blank checks. Nothing could be further from the truth. We always submitted detailed plans to Congress about how we intended to spend the money. Congress approved funds for those purposes, and then all the assistance managed by aid is highly planned. It goes through multiple levels of approval, including by auditors and financial management specialists and, you know, strategic planners to ensure that it's really contributing to the objectives at hand. You know, we just have such sophisticated accountability systems. The idea that somehow this is money that we were just dumping out of the back of a truck is frankly absurd.
We are talking to Danielle Reif, who was a part of USAID for 20 years as a diplomat, program head, overseeing various projects, which we'll get to in a couple of those as we go along here. And she is currently the head of Peace Builders Initiative, their website, peacebuildersunite.com, and you are listening to Issues and Ideas. Why do you can you put your finger on any one thing or one element of USAID that put it in Donald Trump's crosshairs? Because we do a feature here on the show. I did it during the election as a warning of here's what's coming. I still do it now as a, see, if you read this, you would have known this was coming. There were an excerpt reading from Project 2025. And if you do a search in Project 2025 of USAID, there's a lot of mentions, and none of them are good.
That's right. Yeah, certainly within USAID, I think many individuals had read Project 2025 and understood some of the things that might come our way. Of course, Donald Trump, up until the election, denied that he had been a part of that. It's kind of like a Trojan horse situation, yeah. In my opinion. You know, he said it wasn't him and he wasn't involved. But then as soon as he was inaugurated, he started to roll out those plans very quickly and very aggressively. You know, some people have compared the situation in the U.S. to other countries with increasing authoritarianism or closing political space for civil society and for rights. And, you know, I've heard experts say that what Trump has done in the U.S. is far faster and far more aggressive than, you know, for example, Orban in Hungary. It took him years to do what Trump has done in just a few months here in the U.S.
Well, it helps when you have the legislative side already bowing to you as opposed to having to tear down and replace that too, along with everything else you want to try to replace.
Yeah, I am concerned that there is a culture of fear and intimidation, that some of the tactics that are being used are preventing people in key positions, whether it's in Congress or the judiciary or the civil service or civil society, from standing up and doing what is consistent with their views and consistent with democratic governance. There's just a lot of intimidation and fear, and the kind of language that's being used is scary sometimes. And so I understand why that happens. On the other hand, I also have seen statistics that nonviolent collective action is, you know, growing and is doing better than it has in many, many years, even in a few short months. The level of civil society engagement and people getting out on the streets and voicing their concerns, using their free speech, is also significant. So I think the greater the authoritarian threat that we see, the more people are going to get on the streets, and I just hope that it stays nonviolent. That's an important piece of this puzzle, because as soon as civil society, you know, is seen as being provocative, then I fear, you know, all the indicators are there for our country to move towards greater political violence. And so my interest as a peace builder really is to promote nonviolence, and make sure everybody knows that actually nonviolent social change is more effective than violent campaigns at creating social change. So, it's a difficult situation we find ourselves in, but we can turn it around, and we can turn it around through heavy engagement of citizens, just pushing back, advocating for democracy, advocating for peace, advocating for our shared values as Americans.
That's something we saw a lot of what just happened back on April 5th in that the day of protest around the nation, where no one threatened to kill anybody, no one threatened to burn down buildings, and depending on where the various rallies took place, anywhere between hundreds to tens of thousands showed up.
That's right. But that's right. I was very inspired by that rally. I was encouraged by how widespread it was. I was encouraged by the numbers. And like you said, I was especially encouraged by the energy there and the fact that it was very much nonviolent across the board.
But the secret is to maintain and to further grow it. That's where some of these efforts wind up being just a whim of the moment as opposed to an action of substance.
That's right. That's right. The nonviolent collective action movement in response to authoritarianism has been growing. There has been a lot of increased momentum over many years. It has not yet achieved the status of a, you know, very big, visible mass movement, coherent mass movement. But I know a lot of groups are working towards that, and there's a lot of effort to build community among the different movements. And sooner or later, it'll come together. I believe that. I believe that, and I see that happening behind the scenes. So let's just hope that the nonviolence prevails and that citizens are courageous enough to use their voices, even when it's scary and when it's hard, to defend and protect and promote democracy and peace in the U.S.
We have to wrap up here, but that's certainly part of the work that Peace Builders Initiative is doing. We put the link up at our homepage, peacebuildersunite.com. Then there's a great 25-page handbook, technically, called Six Ways to Be a Peace Builder. And that's the key word, a peace builder. There's two elements to the idea: to bring peace, to do it peacefully, and to build something that will preserve and return peace to whatever the situation is, like the here and now, as a great example. And keep an eye out for Danielle's book, Overcoming the Information Chaos, A Guide to Cultivating Peaceful Communities in the Digital Age. PeaceBuildersUnite.com, the website. Danielle, thank you so much for your service in so many ways to not just our nation through USAID, but through everyone that you touched and everything that you oversaw to make sure it went right and went just and went fair, as democracy should be. Thank you for the work you're doing and helping us realize the empowerment we have to push back peacefully against what we see that's happening, which is wrong. And thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you so much, Chris.